It's Thursday, October 22nd, 2015. This is the Hermetic Hour. And tonight we will air an interview of your host, Pope Runyon, Very Honored Frater D.A.L., conducted by Ed Reeb, Very Honored Frater B.T., on his own Esoterra Nerd podcast show. Now, Ed is a Golden Dawn Inner Order member and the son of the late magician and college professor John Dan Reeb, who was one of Polk's close friends and confidants. The interview is enlivened as they share memories of John's outrageous guerrilla radio broadcasts. Polk and John both studied Franz Barden and were both fascinated by Richard Schaefer. This interview will take you back to the days of Simon King of the Witches here in the Los Angeles area. It is both fun and informative. So if you want to return with us to the 1970s and 80s, tune in and we will tell it like it was.
Would you mind telling us a little bit about your name? Are you related to the...
All of the Runyons all come out of New Jersey, and we are all descendants of a very, very old carpenter, a French carpenter by the name of Vincent Runyon, who came over around the time of the Mayflower, and he landed in New Jersey, and he was a maritime carpenter. And he was very prolific. So he founded the Runyon family, and of course our most famous Runyon is Damon Runyon, you know, the journalist and the writer who wrote about the New York gangsters and all of that. In fact, the term Runyon-esque has been used to describe his writings.
Interesting.
But then I have a cousin, Charlie Runyon, Charlie W. Runyon, who was also a writer, and I understand he ended up being interested in the occult too, but I haven't been able to get a hold of him, and still trying to track him down.
Your actual first name is Carol, right?
Yeah, and my dad, that was inflicted on me by my father, and his name was Carol, and he was an attorney, and he thought, of course, that he was a very, very, very successful attorney, and he thought that I would follow in his footsteps, and so he named me Carol Runyon Jr. Well, Carol with two R's and two L's is the masculine spelling, you know, it's like
right.
Carol Shelby. I even ended up working for Carol Shelby, which was interesting, but like Carol Shelby or Carol Baker, but kids at school don't know that. So I
came in for a lot of
teasing when I was a kid.
Drag.
It was like being the boy named Sue, you know.
Yeah, and, you probably related with that song, I can imagine.
Yeah, and of course that did have an advantage because if you get picked on enough. Then when I got in the Army, you know, and every Saturday night, I was a squad leader, and every Saturday night I had to get in the boxing ring, you know. In those days in the Army, boy, we did a lot of boxing and make us more aggressive, I guess.
Yeah.
And, you know, so... that all started with being named Carol. And then of course this nickname Polk, I preferred that to Carol because I still had the stigma of having to fight when I was 7 years old, having to fight my way home from school every day. And so
Polk at least has a masculine ring.
It has more of a sexual connotation in England, but not here so much. But
right.
The way I got that was my mother was pregnant longer than she should have been, and so when I finally arrived, she said, "Well, here you are, Pokey." And so, so it kind of stuck, and I ended up using it as a pen name, and then I decided, you know, at a certain point that I wanted to change it and go back to Carol, which I thought was better for a writer.
But my agent just said, he said, oh, good heavens, don't change it, you know. And of course, he was thinking about the English connotation, I think.
And anyway, then you're also known as the Master Fabian?
Yeah, and that, you know, I know you mentioned down here this sounds like Therian, and I know it kind of does. However, Therian means beast in Greek.
Ah. Uh-huh.
And Fabian means that he was the first Hierophant of the Phoenicians, according to Sancho Nealco.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's legit.
And so therefore, not because we have a...
Just because it sounds the same doesn't mean it.
Yeah, we have a Phoenician.
Well, but there was that plus the similar sounding order, O-T-O, O-T-A.
Well, OTA, yeah, the OTO is the Ordo Templi Orientis,
right.
And the OTA is the Order of the Temple of Astarte.
Right.
But it's also, it's confused sometimes with the Builders of the Adytum, which is the BOTA.
Right,
know?
Yeah, people say ZOTA or BOTA. Yeah, you have to focus on that.
I'll admit there probably was some influence on the Ordo Templi, you know, that aspect of it.
Fair enough.
But I've long since given up Crowley. As I think you probably know, because I mentioned that, you know, I'm...
Yeah, I'm kind of interested in that, because my dad told me, you know, indirectly, he basically said, stay away from Crowley, which was the reason I joined a traditional Golden Dawn order, because I was... After he died, I didn't have anyone to ask questions to, so I just started seeking out teachers that my dad had recommended. And so that's where I ended up, you know.
Your father may have been reflecting some of my experiences, because, you know, your father was one of my best friends, and I shared a lot of my experiences with him, and quite frankly, when I first got started, and John knew this, and when I first got started, I thought I was a Thelemite.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I did, I kind of admired Crowley. I didn't know back in 1970, there wasn't that much published on Crowley. You know, we really didn't know that much about him. We didn't. In fact, they were kind of the people that were promoting him at that time, just at the beginning of the magical revival.
Mm.
The people that were promoting him were kind of hiding some of the things about him that they didn't want us to know about. And so the more I found out about him, and then the guy who really, really, really turned me off on Tony was Grady McMurtry.
Mm.
And Grady, we were dickering around trying to get us to take some kind of a charter from him, which we didn't, fortunately, didn't accept. Suggested to him that if we you know have the book of the law, it should be private. You know, we should keep it private and not wave it around at people, because you know it's there are parts of it that are so offensive, especially to people who have respect for the religion they were raised in, you know.
Right.
and all that. And Grady just said, no, the law is for everybody. We gotta promote it and all that. And I said,
evangelism.
You can't possibly go wrong without it. The only way I could consider having it would be as just a personal declaration of freedom, that you don't go committing yourself too publicly at all.
Yeah.
And in that sense, it might have been okay. They wanted to go out and wave the flag and talk about how much they hated Christianity and how much they hated, you know, they hated traditional religion, including the Golden Dawn, because what a lot of people don't realize is Crowley stole a lot from the Golden Dawn.
Yeah,
yeah, sure he did. But his expression, his whole rebellion, is more a rebellion against the Golden Dawn than it is anything else.
Yeah.
And
at a particular time and place, which I find interesting what little I know about it. I mean, as sort of a time capsule in history, he's relevant at a particular point in history. His dad was a preacher in Victorian England, and he was on heroin, and he was bisexual in a time when that was absolutely unheard of. And then he joined the fucking Golden Dawn, of all things, when he was 19. He's a really interesting case study. You know, and it's a really, from my point of view, I joined when I was 16, a traditional Golden Dawn order. And so he's interesting to me as a parallel, you know, but so is Yeats, you know, and Paul Foster Case.
Yeah.
Who put him up on over the mantle tend to not be quite as interested in those others. But I mean, I there are a few, though, that'll say, no, I like Dion Fortune a lot, and I like Paul Foster Case a lot,
I really find a Dion Fortune. In fact, if you listened to the Hermetic Hour last night, I was reading from Dion Fortune on Gabura, and I'm very, very fond of Dion Fortune. But
yeah.
But she said, of course, about Crowley, she said he didn't know the difference between a priestess and a whore.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
kind of a reference
well,
to Thunder Perfect Mind.
And yet, at the same time, Dion Fortune was very much in favor of liberation of the feminine and veneration of the feminine.
Yeah, just
even
not in Crowley's way.
and even feminine sexuality too, but not in Crowley's way. Crowley, as far as Crowley was concerned, and a lot of women in the OTO do not realize this, and the OTO doesn't encourage him to find out about it, but Crowley had absolute contempt for women.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought that, he believed that they didn't even have souls. He was just completely contemptuous of them. You can't have, I don't believe you can have a magical order without a balance without the women. In fact, if you're doing magic in a group and you don't have any women in the group, you don't have that dynamic.
Something's missing.
And,
that's why the Masons are so stale.
Well, yeah, they're sterile in some ways, but not in others, because masonry has a lot of power. In fact, I thought I knew. You know, I'm going to tell you the truth. I thought I knew. Everything there was to know about masonry before I became a Mason.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I did, because I'd read all the rituals, you know, and all that.
Yeah.
But when I got entered, passed, and raised at a local lodge in Woodland Hills, as a matter of fact, and that a bunch of businessmen could get together and do something that powerful was amazing to me. And it really was. So I have a tremendous respect for Masonry.
Yeah.
Well, they definitely
have a lot of history and a lot of astral current behind them, and, you know, connecting to people, centuries of people and shared collective ideas.
Well, like I said, we are in now, right now, in magic. And this is very much along the line with the Golden Dawn. We are right now in magic, in the Masonic phase. The Rosicrucian phase preceded the Masonic phase, and before that we had the classical pagan phase in the Renaissance, where they revived classical paganism.
Hmm.
And then they went through the Rosicrucian, and then they integrated Kabbalah and out of the Rosicrucian phase, we entered the Masonic phase, and that's where you have Solomon's Temple. And so much of the Golden Dawn, good Lord, the biblical aspects
right.
of the Golden Dawn are tremendous. And
yeah,
the Golden
Dawn
is very much
owes a great deal to the Mason.
In fact, you could say that the Golden Dawn, the advent of the Golden Dawn, represented the Masonic phase of ceremonial magic. I think that's a fair thing to say.
Or even a blossoming of Masonry. The Masons didn't want to own it, but it was coming out of Masonry, and you know, just those factors. I love that idea of of, who was it, Budge down there at the British Museum hanging out with Mathers, and Mathers picking his brain and running through his SRIA material and his, he was probably a member of three or four other orders, maybe even the OTO, and then but drawing it all together and those ciphers. Now, there's something. That's not on the script, though.
Well, there's not in the script, but now that you mention it,
you need this book.
Don't you, that's true. That reminded me when when he did that. I saw that happen. Everybody line up with a check in their hands or money in their hands, and this line, and it reminded me of that scene in Conan the Barbarian when James Earl Jones gets out there and he looks up at the top of the cliff, and there's this young girl up there, and he says, "Come to me, my child." And she jumps off the cliff and to her death, And then he turns around to Schwarzenegger, and he says, "No, that's power, boy."
Creepy.
You're talking about when I met your father.
What were the circumstances? When did you meet my dad? Yeah.
Well, I met your father. I don't recall the first time I did, but we started the OTA in Pasadena.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I actually started in Topanga, but then Topanga almost burned down, so we moved to Pasadena, we had this old Amy Semple McPherson church that we had. It's still there, but now it's the Southern Baptist Church now. John, your father.
Mm-hmm.
was a teacher at Pasadena City College.
Mm, very nearby.
Yeah, and our original OTA membership, most of it came from Pasadena College.
Ah.
In fact, it was a little group in Pasadena College that called itself the Crowley for Lunch Bunch, because they were they were into Crowley at that time. And at that time, I still was kind of into Crowley, too, at that time,
mm-hmm.
when we first got started. So I met, John shortly after we started having the Pasadena students over. And I found out, of course, when I met John, that we shared two authors that we were both of us very much admired and studied. And one of them was Franz Barton.
Mm-hmm.
And John was very much into Franz Barton and also Richard Shaver. And I had really been hooked on Richard Shaver when I was a kid, and I was about 16, and I thoroughly believed that in Shaver's mythology. But I eventually came to the conclusion that, well, if Shaver's mythology must exist, those caverns must exist in another dimension, and I finally reconciled it that way. I don't think, frankly, to tell you the truth, I don't think John ever quite got to that point. I think he thought they were still down there, and they're still down there anyway in another dimension, regardless. Mm.
That's the subterranean, the lizard people and all that?
Yeah, right. Well, they weren't the
David
lizard
Icke
people. They weren't the lizard people. They called them the Darrows.
Oh.
And we did a film, just a little while ago. I don't know whether you've heard about it. It's called Beyond Lemuria. And we used a lot of the Shaver mystery in that film.
Interesting.
If your father had still been alive, he would have been in that film. I guarantee you, he would have been. And I had a perfect role for him, but he passed on, unfortunately.
Which role is
that? If you've seen the film, I would have had John play the professor Leslie Pearson, who originally developed the intergravitron. That would have been.
Nice. Well, now I'll
in
have
fact,
to watch
it's a matter, it. As a matter of fact, I got the plans for the original intergravitron from your dad.
Yeah, he gave them to me, too.
We built it. Actually, I have a replica of the Hidden World Receiver, which we experimented with.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I never got that far. I just read about it and talked to people about it.
Well, we went a good deal farther in the film. Now, you've seen Beyond Lemuria, haven't you?
I haven't.
Oh yeah, but we gotta get that too.
Yeah, yeah.
It's still available on Amazon.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and I'll send you a copy.
Thank you.
I would have cast John as Leslie Pearson, the professor, who is a character out of Dweller on Two Planets by Frederick Spencer Oliver. We combined Dweller on Two Planets with the Shaver mystery, and so we could have the good guys go up Mount Shasta and the bad guys go in the caverns under Mount Shasta.
Hmm.
And it's kind of a neat movie. You'll enjoy it.
Yeah.
But anyway,
so was this the 60s or the was it 19?
No, this was the early 70s.
Okay.
This was about 19. I think I first met John around about 1972.
Okay.
So
he was divorced. It was before he and my mom started.
Yeah, when I first met him, he was married to your mother.
Okay.
'73. That's probably about right.
Yeah.
And as I recalled, he had met Rigardi, but not along with me. Okay.
That had happened previously.
Yeah, he had met. He told me he had met with Rigardi, but I knew Rigardi, and I won't call myself exactly a student of Rigardi, but I was certainly spent a lot of time with Rigardi because mainly at that time Rigardi was in his Telemach phase, and I think he was primarily trying to get me together with Grady McMurtry, was his idea, and that of course fortunately did not occur, but. Let's see here. And I was going to mention to you too about your dad. This was after his divorce, but he got himself an Isuzu Trooper.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he got himself an Isuzu Trooper, and we used to go take midnight rides within that vehicle.
Nice.
And I remember one time we went charging out to Giant Rock, and John, on a whim, John called up and he said, "We're gonna jump to Giant Rock." That's what he called it, a jump, and he came by and we go out to Giant Rock and drive around out there in the middle of the night. Now, John also, but never forget this. John had a big CB radio.
Yeah.
That Trooper.
Yeah.
And this thing was a tremendously powerful CB radio.
Breaker 1-9 radio check.
and what John liked to do, and we did it several times. He liked to go up to the top of Kegel Mountain in that thing. Did he ever take you up to the top of Kegel Mountain in it?
Yeah.
Well, did he ever let you listen in to any of his clandestine radio broadcasts?
A bit. A clandestine? I don't know about that.
Well, yeah. Now, what he did, John had as you know, and as my daughter just loved John, by the way.
Yeah.
As John had a tremendous sense of humor. He really did. He had a tremendous sense of humor, and like he used to read from Franz Barden to his freshman English class in a thick German accent. But he had a bunch of characters. Like Fred Skelton had all these different characters, and like Bolivar Shagnasty and all that, but John had a kind of a Saturday Night Live kind of a totally politically incorrect by today's standards. He had these characters that he would do, and he would broadcast, and from the top of Kegel Mountain. And then he hit all the CB, that big CB network. Most of these guys were truckers.
Yeah.
And most of them were, and what John loved to do was to tick off these truckers with these skits that he would do. and these guys were, most of them are rednecks and the kind of guys that don't take their baseball cap off, all night. And probably sleep in it.
Yeah.
and he would he would get on the CB and do these broadcasts, and then they would call back and threaten him and you know, get mad at him. And I remember one time he I don't know whether I guess we can do this one. He had this character character Rudra Singh, you know, who comes.
Hey, God, this is Rudra Singh, and I am trying to find the Temple of Durga in Van Nuys. And I want to find the Temple of Durga in Van Nuys because they are going to deflower the Baptist virgins, the 16-year-old Baptist virgins, and then these truckers would come back at him and say, "You damn godhead, we're going to get a hold of you." and he's, "What are you going to do with these 16-year-old virgins?" And Judge, "Oh, we're going to rub them all over with ghee and do the foot foot, oh yeah." And these guys would get furious. and Vivian would just, she'd just be in stitches. She just, and then John, they'd cuss John out so much that he must have gotten to thinking that they were going to RDF him or something, but that he'd reach a certain point when he'd get him ticked off enough, and then we'd roar down the mountain, you know.
Yeah.
And then he had another character called Father O'Malley of the Fat Fathers of Faith, and they were looking for altar boys.
Yeah.
Oh boy. So he had us both in stitches, and anyway so I gotta tell you, I miss him.
Oh yeah.
Really.
Yeah, his legit CB handle was Mountain Man, but he'd occasionally run into another Mountain Man, and they'd have a little territorial battle about who gets to call himself Mountain Man, you know.
You know, well, I'm glad you got in on some of that, because
I played along. We would go out by TA truck stop, and I'd get on there, and my voice hadn't changed yet, so I'd say, "This is Jessica, and I'm looking for Juicy Beaver."
Oh! Oh, that brings back memories. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Good time.
Okay.
Was the Church of Hermetic Sciences, how is that connected to the OTA? Is it the same thing?
Yes and no, and here's the reason why. We started with the OTA. I mean, that was what we started with. We had the mirror method, you know, the facial reflection mirror method, which I had developed when I was desperately ill. And so I had my partner and right hand man at that time was Nelson White, and we were thinking, you know, well, we got to get this thing, you know, we got to make this have this order build it into an institution, you know, and really get it going. And Nelson was the one that said, "Well, let's be real smart about this. Let's just don't try to incorporate like the Masons or something like that. Let's have a church, and the church can sponsor an order." And Nelson was really, really smart in that regard. And so we did. So we created the Church of the Hermetic Sciences primarily to sponsor the OTA. That was the main reason. Although the church has since become, you know, more of its own entity, and it has its own, you know, certain of our rituals are actually, we would consider them church rituals. You know,
interesting.
And
as opposed to OTA rituals.
Yeah, well, the OTO did the same thing. In fact, I advised, after Nelson had come up with this idea, I advised McMurtry to do that. He hadn't incorporated the OTO yet, and he was bound and determined he wasn't going to make a church out of it. But later on, they actually did that. They finally realized that was the smarter way to go.
Yeah,
But we have enough rituals, and we fulfill all of the categories of a church, and so I don't mind admitting that the order was the inspiration for it.
Right.
But because it fills all the qualifications of a church, and I've married people, you know, and one of my marriages is still holding up, it's still holding together. Yeah. So the corporation, we got our corporation approved in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been, we've been a church and an order ever since.
Oh, I wanted to ask you, I found out recently about another name, Very Honored Frater D.A.L. Would you be willing to share anything about that?
Oh, sure. That's, when I started off with the Golden Dawn, which was years and years and years and years ago,
mm-hmm.
I took the motto, Quero Lucem, I seek the light.
Mm.
And then, when I finally got, I'm not going to say over, what grade I am, because
I understand.
Mm-hmm. This is something we just don't like to do. But let's put it this way: I am in the RRADC.
Sure.
And so when I got to a certain grade in the RRADC, I decided it was time to change it to Ducero ad Lucem, which means I lead to the light.
Mm.
So that's what DAL means.
Excellent.
And I asked my premonstrator if it would be okay to mention our temple and a little bit about it, because I figured you'd probably ask me about it, so I can do that. So
the OTA temple, or
the Golden Dawn temple.
Oh, you have a local Golden Dawn temple here?
Yes, we. Well, I say we do, but actually the temple is under the aegis of the Church of Hermetic Sciences, because according to our incorporation papers, we have the right to found magical orders in the plural. We can found all orders, colleges, schools, that sort of thing. So we took the Golden Dawn, a Golden Dawn temple of one of my members and several of our members under our wing in the church.
It's what would be considered a Cicero temple.
Yeah, well, yes and no, because we have a good relationship with Chick Cicero,
autonomous.
I've seen Chick several times. In fact, I actually got kind of an informal initiation from him one time, but for one of the grades. However, basically from Chris Monastre, who was a disciple of Regardi's.
I've always wondered who that temple was.
I've met
your members.
That's Regardi's temple. It's the Ma'at temple of the Hermetic Order, the Golden Dawn.
All right.
And Mary Kamer is the premonstrator, and I'm the imperator. And so that's I can't tell you where we meet.
Okay. That's fine.
This is Regardi's old temple. In fact, we even have Regardi's old pillars, we're quite active. In fact, we're gonna help on initiation Sunday. We're doing some neophytes for some guys.
So anyway, if somebody wanted to be a member of that Golden Dawn Temple, how would they go about doing that?
I guess the best way to go about doing that would be to get a hold of Mark Hamer, or get a hold of me, we would
want to meet and apply
we'd meet, and naturally we like to do have little biographies on people, see what they've been up to. One thing we don't like is people who are running around trying to join all the organizations.
Right.
In fact, I recently turned down one candidate because she had a list of all these organizations that she'd gotten herself into, and I just looked at that and I turned around to Merrick and I said, "Oh, come on, Merrick, she's just collecting paper."
Right.
and
That's. But most of our recruits, most of them hear about us from word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons why we've kept such a low profile, and is all of the awful slanders and stuff that went on the old Alt Magic group, my friend Pat Zaleski got just slaughtered, and I came in for a lot of abuse myself, and Pat Beeman, Chris Monastro, she was horrified by all of that.
Yeah.
So she said, we'll never go on the internet, And,
yeah.
And so we've been very reluctant to do that.
Well, thank you for choosing this moment to come out of hiding.
Well, yeah, okay.
There are a few people listening.
I know, and however, I don't feel really, in a way, I don't feel like we're any longer on the menu,
Right.
And after that, I published the Cypher Manuscript book. I think people like Robert Word, aren't going to. They aren't going to try to say that I can't say what I'm saying, that's okay. I'll fess up to it, I'm doing what I'm doing, been there, done that. I'm still there, and I'm still doing that.
I wanted to ask: is the current now? So we've established that Ordo Templi Astarte is a separate order from the Golden Dawn Temple, underneath the Church of Hermetic Sciences. What are the differences and similarities between the currents?
We're Golden Dawn compatible as far as correspondences are concerned. I think it's really, really dumb to have a magical order in this day and time and try to change Golden Dawn correspondences.
Right.
Because they did a lot of work. That's the best job since Trithenius and Cornelius Agrippa put together the three books of occult philosophy. The Golden Dawn's been the best synthesis, and they have the color schemes and the basic correspondences and all. It's BSA, best stuff available.
Right.
So we go along with Golden Dawn correspondences. What we don't go along with is locked into their astrology, which is not tropical. Their astrology is sidereal, and we use tropical astrology.
Okay.
So that's one difference. Although we have a system in our inner order in the OTA. We have a system that sort of combines both sidereal and tropical.
Interesting.
It's a sort of what you see is what you get. In fact, we have a tablature for the celestial sphere that's probably. I know this sounds a little presumptuous, but I think what we've reconstructed is what originally what Dee and Kelly were trying to do with their Enochian tablets, but didn't do it.
Hmm.
They ended up splitting up, with the Golden Dawn tablets. They ended up splitting up, putting all the fire signs in one quarter and all the air signs in another quarter.
Right.
And so you can't stand in the middle of the universe, not the way it is. You can they break it up according to elements. That's a philosophy, I suppose as a computer program, it's okay for the brain, but I would rather stand inside the magic circle and kind of imagine myself in the middle of the universe. That's another concept too. And the Golden Dawn's Kabbalah is very Zoharic,
and or at least Zoharic as far as Rosenroth's version of the Zohar. And we don't use a cliffoth. And the cliffoth, that concept, we prefer a more Dante-esque Tartarus. And that works better with Galatia because I don't know whether you ever read Steve Sabdo's a book on Goetic evocation, but he made the mistake, I think, and I think he admits this at this point, of putting his Goetic spirits in the cliffoth. And boy, he got them, but be careful what you ask for.
Yeah, you know, that's honestly because I come from, you know, a system that is more Zohar based and does think of the Goetia as the cliffothic counterparts of the Shem. I haven't worked with them. I only work with the Shem, so I can see how it would be different if you're evoking them. Not in that context. If you're invoking them
as they are written, see, it Quatia is, if you read it as it's written, that is definitely not, those spirits are definitely not cliffothic. And there's no way you can justify them being cliffothic. Right. And quite frankly, the cliffoth is not just a...
They're extreme ideas. Yeah, they're not beings. A little cliffoth and
well,
go to
yeah,
critters, you know.
Oh, well, sure. But the idea of putting pagan gods in the cliffoth.
Yeah, it's sort of a rude Christian.
It's a sort of okay, we defeated them. Now we're gonna kill them. You know. Now we're gonna demonize them. And part of what our mythos in the OTA is to bring Baal and Astarte, who are in the Goetic, in the Goetia very definitely, is to bring them up and rehabilitate them as a god and a goddess, and we use the Goetia in order to do that.
That's where the Canaanite thing comes in.
Yeah, right, and where the Solomon thing comes in too, because Solomon was actually built a temple to Astarte
but in the common version in the Gideon's Bible it says that was where he screwed up and then Israel got divided in half and they've been fucked ever since.
Well, that's true, but then Israel Israel was mostly Canaanite anyway. The so-called lost tribes of Israel were never lost. They never left. They stayed there, and the Judeans got hauled off into captivity, or at least they say they did, and then they came back, and then during the Maccabee period, they tried to convince the rest of the Israelites that they were the original tribes of Israel. They enforced it on them. I mean, they pushed it on them. Ezra wasn't so much an evangelist. It was the Maccabees that really ran with it, and trying to Judaize the rest of Israel. The rest of Israel was primarily before the Maccabees got at them. They were mostly Canaanites and Phoenicians.
So it seems like it's identifying with the plight of the equivalent of the Palestinians a few thousand years ago.
Very, very much like that. It's very similar to what's going on today. Although I am not, I've got to tell you, even though I'm very much in a lowest, and in other words, there's two sides to the Bible. The Bible, in fact, there's two books. There's different books in the Bible, and one set of books is the Elohist books, and the other set is the Yahwehist books. And what Ezra tried to do is put the two Bibles together, and make them. And everywhere it said El, he stuck in Yahweh. Ezra actually wrote the Bible, the Old Testament as we have it now. He wrote it, and he wrote it with Cyrus the Persian looking over his shoulder. And, you know, because he was Cyrus's client. He was Cyrus's proxy conqueror of Palestine, and Cyrus wanted him to control Palestine for the Persian Empire. And of course Herod, when Herod finally took over after the last of the Maccabees, Herod took over, and Herod was an Edomite, really, really, the Romans wanted to do the same thing. They wanted Herod to take over and run Palestine for the Romans, and which he did. And so there's a lot. This Canaanite tradition persisted and continued all the way up through to Jesus, who was primarily a Galilean.
Right.
Although he was related to Herod, but he was Herod's grandson. But he was raised in Galilee, and he had a Galilean point of view, and all his disciples were Galilean, and so they essentially this, and of course his wife Mary Magdalene, she was definitely Galilean. So there's a lot about all of this that Christians and Jewish people just don't realize at all. They don't understand it, and yet it's interesting. It is kind of continuing. You see the same stuff going on today.
Repeating themselves now. But on the other hand, the Golden Dawn Temple that you imperate, is that, can that be made into a verb?
No, our Golden Dawn Temple, we don't change anything.
No Canaanite gods.
I'm not trying to, and Merrick wouldn't let me try to make it a Lois.
Right.
I'm not going to get in there and pull out YHVH and sticky and L everywhere. I'm not going to do that. Because it's just like, actually, and this brings up a point with these Thelemic Golden Dawns. Remember I mentioned
that? Yeah, I was wondering why had a kind of a knee-jerk reaction against the idea of a Thelemic Golden Dawn.
Oh, boy, do I ever have a knee-jerk reaction against it. And the reason is just what we just said.
Yeah.
I would never, never try to enforce some of my beliefs and the beliefs we have in the OTA about the lowest, the Canaanite lowest tradition. I wouldn't do that to the Golden Dawn. The Golden Dawn is you don't change it. And in fact, Chick Cicero up at Pantheacon a couple of years ago, Chick Cicero told us a story about his background. And he said that he had a temple in Tennessee or somewhere around there, where he was doing both the Golden Dawn and the OTO. He had the Golden Dawn. He had one room for the OTO, and then he would and he had a lodge room, and then he had one.
And then he was building the vault in the other room.
Yeah, and he'd strike the OTO set and set up the Golden Dawn set, and do both. Which, by the way, a number of people do.
I've been finding that out lately.
But he said that both Rigardi and McMurtry both told him not to do it.
Mm-hmm.
They said, "Don't mix the two systems."
Right.
Both of them, and that brings up the point, because there are two different currents. The Golden Dawn is Isis and Osiris. And the OTO is Horus.
Right.
And there is a lot of difference.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of difference in it, because Horus is, as Corby said, the crowned and conquering child. And Horus is very, very angry war god. He's the avenger, of course, of Osiris. But still, the
so
Horus
you,
current.
You wouldn't approve of, like, Jews for Jesus?
No, I really wouldn't, and I'll tell you why. Because Jesus wouldn't approve of it either.
Okay.
Yeah, and he wouldn't. Granted, he was trying. I think Jesus was trying to bring the Jews around to to worshiping El rather than YHVH. I think that's what he was trying to do. I think that's almost obvious if you look at the whole history of it.
Right.
And Jesus was a priest after the order of Melchizedek, and Melchizedek was a priest of El, and he was Canaanite. And so I think until the priesthood of Melchizedek is recognized both by the Christians and the Jews, that Jews for Jesus is not going to work.
Okay, so Jews for Jesus is scratched, and Thelemic Golden Dawn is scratched. But OTO's okay, like, right? Like, on their own.
They're okay for themselves. I mean, it's okay. But look, it's okay for themselves. As far as I'm concerned, frankly, the Book of the Law, it bothered me way back when I was thinking about taking that charter from McMurtry. It mm-hmm. bothered me, and I didn't want to wave it around in public, but I was willing to accept it as a private personal declaration of freedom for people. You know that.
Yeah.
That I was, but still, I finally come to the conclusion that no, it isn't even good for that, because frankly. As we say in the Golden Dawn, you and I and all the rest of the Golden Dawn folks, we take an oath to respect other people's religions.
Well, technically, it's given in the speech of the Hieris, not in the oath. But I get what you're saying.
No, I think there's one of the oaths. Well, maybe you're wrong, but anyway, it's you're told,
right.
Yeah, you're told by one of the higher.
What right have
he charges
you? Desecrate
he
that
charges you
sacred
not to,
in another
yeah,
side.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. You,
yeah,
you're
yeah.
You're I ought to know. I've done IRS enough times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is
I am? what is that? What that line? You know, I am. Called fortitude for the unhappy.
And I am the master of darkness.
Yeah, master of darkness, and I am called fortitude by the unhappy. Yeah, and well, fortitude by the unhappy tells you you're supposed to respect other people's religions, and I think the Book of the Law in that respect is really offensive. And
but ironically, they pull the yeah, but we're a religion, shouldn't you respect us? They know the loophole in the Golden Dawn.
Oh, I know, yeah. Yeah, but the whole thing about it is, as far as the Thelemic Golden Dawn is concerned, the idea of trying to abrogate the Osiris current.
Right.
And when we do an Osiris communion and everything in the Golden Dawn, and this Rosicrucian, the Golden Dawn is definitely Rosicrucian. And so to try to make the Golden Dawn Thelemic, to me, is...
Well,
the only justification
it like.
For it is okay, Crowley grabbed so much of it, so we're Crowleyites, and so we're going to grab the rest of it, you know, and that's that seems to be I just don't think if you're going to do the Golden Dawn, do the Golden Dawn.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if they were innovating, like if they're doing some new version of the vault with a universal hexagram, you know, I'd be interested in seeing it. But I prefer the Victorian style myself.
Well, anything that's worth doing is worth doing the way it is worth doing. In other words, it's worth doing the way it's done.
My dad taught me learn the rules before you learn how to break them.
Yeah. And he was absolutely right about that. Now, you asked me if I remembered your father's book. Yes, I did, and I had a chance to read it, and I believe I returned it to you. I found it quite good. And in fact, you ought to try to maybe try to publish it and get it on Amazon.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I've been doing snippets here on the podcast of a segment called Transformations and Footnotes, where the footnotes are me babbling about it.
Yeah, well, they say your dad was a genius, all right.
Yeah.
And genius with a wonderful sense of humor and as I say, one of the, he was a national treasure that hadn't been discovered yet.
Yeah, I think he preferred to be behind the scenes.
The question that you wanted to add, that you added, that I wish you did, that I was very glad you did add. Okay, The you want to know what the
The Tibetan connection. You've got these Tibetan empowerments, and I wanted to know if and how that ties in with the OTA.
Okay, that's the best question of the evening.
Excellent.
as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 1985, I'd wrapped up my got my master's degree in 1980 from California State University, Northridge.
Mm-hmm.
But I was still keeping in touch with him, you know, and my mentor on my master's committee was a very very astute anthropologist and mystic, Dr. Ravitz. And Dr. Ravitz had been over to Dharamsala several times and had became an initiate of the Sakya order. And Dr. Ravitz informed me in 1985 that the Sakya order of Tibetan Buddhism, what most people would call a red hat order, were coming over here with an initiatory program and an instruction program. And that Dr. Ravitz thought that I ought to get involved in it, and he told me he'd sponsor me and all that, and so I did, and I and several of my of OTA people, and some Gardnerian people, we all got into this program, and they came over. And they were headed by Luding Ken Rinpoche, who was the abbot of Nagore Monastery at the time, or had a Nagore Monastery in Tibet that had been they'd run out of there, but they were camping in Dharamsala along with the Dalai Lama.
Mm-hmm.
And so they put on a program which went on for about 2 weeks, and then they took off for Singapore. They already had a center here of Californian folks who were doing their program. So they were reinforcing the Sakya Center here.
Mm-hmm.
And which I, as far as I know, it's no longer the Sakya Center. I think it's moved somewhere else. But then they rented a big, gosh, it was like a great big warehouse penthouse in Santa Monica. It was like something out of a Doctor Strange comic book. I mean, it was this way down in this kind of industrial section, and there was this great big warehouse, and on top of this was a big penthouse.
Mm-hmm.
On top of this warehouse, and it was kind of spooky, and you had sort of a back alley parking lot, and then you walked up a long flight of stairs, and then he went to the door, you know, and then they had a peephole in this door, you know, and it's just kind of a, you know, like a Joe sent me kind of a thing, you know, and he'd let you in, and then they'd converted the whole inside of this penthouse into a simulacrum of a Tibetan monastery, you know.
Nice.
Drapes hanging around and everything, and whatever. And the best part of it was, however, that they had an American boy from Harvard who called himself Som Ten, who had written their manual for them, helped them write their manual, and translated everything for us in English. So we did not have to, you know. And most, you know, Ravitz had told me, he said, you know, what you're going to get, he said, a lot of people would have given their whole fortunes to have what you're going to get. And, you know, he said, I know you'll get the most out of it. And I said, well, you know, I'll sure try. And so we had this Lama Som Ten, who was this Ivy Leaguer who'd gone over there and learned Tibetan and become a Lama. And he would translate the entire the sadhanas and the initiations and everything for us, and this made it absolutely, you know, this made it good as gold, because we weren't just sitting there with them mumbling at us in Tibetan and Sanskrit and us trying to follow, like so often happens in these
right.
initiations. And believe me, since then I took a lot of Tibetan initiations, and that's what happened with most of them. You were lucky if you got some kind of a program sheet that gave you an idea of what you were doing.
Yeah.
But but we got it all straight. We heard exactly what we were supposed to hear, and exactly, you know, it was all as if we could understand Tibetan. It was that good. And so we started off with Hei Vajra, which is their patron deity, and we did that. And we started off with actually a little prep to begin with before the crew ever got over. We started off with Chenrezig and with some preliminary training, and then they all arrived, and then we started off with Hei Vajra and that empowerment, and then we got into the real meat of the program, which was Vajrayogini.
Mm-hmm.
And Vajrayogini is the goddess of the sorcerers. And she has since become so popular after the Sakya order came over here with her, and she's since become so popular that she's been elevated to a high level tantra. When they brought her over in 85, she was a mid level tantra.
Hmm.
But if you look her up on the internet, Vajrayogini, you will see that she's considered to be high level. But we got that went through that whole program and a beautiful syllabus for it and all of the graphics and everything we needed, and you know it was a wonderful experience. But I learned so much, and one thing I learned, which was one of the most significant things I learned, was that the Tibetans have a different psychic center system for every deity they practice. So this completely confirmed my suspicion, and I'd suspected this before because I'd read a lot of, you know, Tibetan work, you know, the Evans-Wentz stuff and all of that. I suspected this, and I had suspected it for a long time, but then they confirmed it. And you don't find this out until you actually take one of these initiations for a deity, for a Dakini, for a Malakala or something. You don't find out that, and this is the important thing about Tibetan initiations is the interiorization of the entity.
Yeah.
Yeah, the interiorization of the entity and the interiorization of the magical process of the palace of the entity of the and this was something that I had thought years previously. I'd been working on, and we'd been working on in Lodge on this on our own Western psychic center system, based primarily on Gichtel's Gichtel's drawing, which I know you've seen, you know, of the natural man.
Hmm.
And the idea that the tree of life, that the chakra, it isn't just, you know, the middle pillar in the Golden Dawn, which we do. The middle pillar is just a fragment of this, that the full Western system is all seven of the spheres of the tree of life. Right, like you take the lightning flash and you just straighten it out.
Okay.
And yeah, you just take the lightning flash and straighten it out, and the middle pillar, you put them all on the middle pillar. So you just, you know, you start up there with
Saturn.
You start up there with Saturn in the middle of your head, and then you go to Hesed, and you go to Hesed in the third eye, and you go to Gabur in the throat. You go to Gabur in the throat. You go to Tipperath in the chest. You go to Netzach in the solar plexus. You go and Hod below the navel, and Yesod in the genitals, and Malkuth in the rear end, and boom, that's it. And it works like dynamite.
Hmm.
It is so powerful. And this is why I don't know why Crowley never came up with this. I don't know why Barton didn't come up with it. God bless Julius Evola, sure should have. And the only reason why they didn't was because Woodruff's serpent power just dominated everybody. Everybody thought that's the only way they can be. And of course Paul Foster Case he went along with that, and so the BOTA and their people they all do this, and the Golden Dawn too as far as the paths are concerned, because the way most people in the West in the Golden Dawn tradition, the way they do psychic centers is they do them based on the path, on the path system. And they forget about the spheres entirely. And so what we did, what we've done ever since 1974, we've been, even earlier than that, we've been using a straight line system. But we've been drawing power into it like the middle pillar. And we put the cube. Now we've perfected it to the point where we put the cube of space inside the head, and we still use power like the middle pillar. But anyway,
this is OTA practice.
Absolutely, and
not,
doing
not
it,
the Golden Dawn practice.
No. I have a Golden Dawn version of it, which we use Egyptian god forms in the chakras instead of Tenumite. But I'm not trying to force it on the people in Ma'at Temple.
I'm not.
I offer it to them, but if they want to study it, but I'm not going to try to.
I have a friend who did a druidic version. Specifically, he was doing a ritual to help bring peace to Ulster. So he was using the local gods of Ulster instead of the Hebrew gods, and we did a middle pillar that way. It was very interesting.
Well, this extends the whole middle pillar and fills it out and gives you all of the chakras. Now I have a book on it, and we just published the first volume of Hermetic Yoga. We got another volume, the Rosicrucian part of it, coming up next. But the Hermetic Yoga we have a Golden Dawn version, as I said. We're using Egyptian god forms instead of Canaanite. But I'm going to say I just published the Hermetic Yoga Volume 1, which is all of our outer order material, yoga material.
Oh, so that's OTA material.
Yeah, but it is. But unfortunately, for various reasons which I'm not going to get into, I'm only offering it to associate members. So if you want to join get in the associate member program, and that's fine. You can join the associate member program, and then you can get it from us at our printing cost, which is it's just a bargain for what it is. It costs us a fortune because of all the color involved in it.
Yeah, how much being an associate member cost?
We charge $10 to get started, and we send you a membership kit and a certificate and all that. But you can go on our website and we like a letter, from people explaining their background and their occultism and what they're looking for and what they, just kind of a little kind of a magical bio, and then we send them an application, and then they send it back with a $10 money order, and then we send you your membership kit, and along with your coupons. You can get all of our books and videos basically at our cost, and postage included, and we send them out. So it's a good deal.
Interesting.
And the website, our website, where you find all this out, and then once you get in, you join the website, you can get in there and get our lessons and everything on it. And that's www.chsota.org. Boy, that's simple. just chsota.org. www. And of course, we have our big outreach program is the Hermetic Hour, and that's the blog to our blog talk radio show. And I do that every Thursday night, and sometimes I have guests on there and talk about their books and their and what they're doing. And you know, we might have you on there as a guest sometime if you'd like.
Oh, thank
to
you.
Be.
Yeah.
Yeah. The URL for the Hermetic Hour, HTTP / www.blogtalkradio.com/the-hermetic-hour. Now, if that's too long to remember, just go to Google and put in the Hermetic Hour, and they'll get you there.
Nice.
And so, okay, now having gotten that plug in, what are you going to ask?
Yeah, I heard about from Kes Fry, who's written a few books as well, that he and you and my dad at one time went to Philosophical Research Society and saw a lecture by Andrew de Pisano. And I'm also doing some research on Andrew de Pisano because there's not a whole lot known about him, and I'm picking the brains of a lot of his students. I was wondering if you happen to remember that lecture and if you remember Andrew de Pisano.
I do, and the lecture was very stimulating and profound. And of course he I know your dad thought a lot of Pisano. And which I thought was an improvement over Est, and I remember John was into that a bit too.
Yeah.
but Pisano, and he had, I think I have his, I don't know whether I still have his book around here or not. It may have walked away, but I remember I got his book. Yeah, he was a grand old master, yeah, we enjoyed that.
It's really nice to connect with you. I know that you probably remember me when I was very young, but I don't remember you. I don't think we've ever had a conversation before by voice.
I was never very young. Well, I haven't been very young for a long time.
Oh, yeah. But, were you always interested in esoterica, or did that develop at a certain age?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm going to have to. I know that your father would have understood this really well. I have to admit, and I did admit to Richard Toronto of Shavertron, that Richard Shaver was my introduction to the occult.
Hmm.
And that was about when I was about 16 years old. And I was reading these old moldering copies, but that time they were a few years old, moldering copies of Amazing Stories, and I was just soaking it up. Now, Richard Shaver, of course, was an omnivorous reader, and so was Palmer, his co writer and editor. This was all the Atlantis Lemurian stuff, all mixed up with alien astronauts and everything else. And,
right.
And this is what really probably got me interested in the occult. Although I have to admit that my friends who in the science fiction, high school science fiction community, they very quickly talked me out of Shaver. You know, I mean, they kind of made fun of me for believing in that crazy stuff. And but it sort of, you know, I think it's where I first got interested. And then years later, I had a girlfriend who thought she was a witch. She was born on Halloween. And she asked me for a book on magic, and I got her Paul Christian's History and Practice of Magic in a 2 volumes in a slipcase. But I read a lot of it before I gave it to her because I wanted to find out what I was, you know, what I was getting my girlfriend. And that's where I ran across what became the original OTA initiation was in Paul Christian's History and Practice of Magic, which was Paul Christian's own romanticized one degree wrap up of the 7 degrees of the Craterapoa system.
Hmm.
And because we used that eventually for the OTA initiation, because we started the OTA and I read the Golden Dawn initiations, and I thought, oh, you know, these are kind of stodgy, I thought at the time. It's kind of, we need something more dramatic, more exciting. Oh, what was that stuff that I read that I gave my girlfriend, you know, that I ran to the bookstore and I got another copy of it, you know, and read it over again. It's the initiation of the pyramids and Paul Christian's History and Practice of Magic. And in fact, when I send you Beyond Lemuria, you'll see that we use that initiation sort of as the starting point of Beyond Lemuria, the black cup and the white cup on the altar that the candidate faces, and he has to make a choice which one is he going to drink, you know. And that's part of the Paul Christian version of Crater of Paul, which we still use, by the way. And I think also the Saragossa manuscript. I read the Saragossa manuscript when I was in college, and first time in college, you know, and that was back when I was in my 20s. And Saragossa manuscript is an incredible thing. It's a novel, but it's a Decameron type novel, but it's very occult. And in fact, I did an article on it. And some of the Kabbalistic adventures out of it, and reproduced them in the latest seventh ray. That's the green ray. And the green ray is also available from Amazon. The seventh ray, you know, the seventh ray volume 3, the green ray, and that you can get on Amazon. And another plug. but anyway, you know, like Lon Duquette says, shameless self-promotion. Yeah, Lon's better at it than I am. And speaking of Lon is one of the stars of Beyond Lemuria.
Oh.
Yeah, he plays Hermes Trismegistus. We first see him inside the OTA temple when they're just about to do the cups. And then you see him again at the end on top of Mount Shasta.
Excellent.
In vision. Yeah, and he delivers the ultimate message from the top of the holy mountain up there in his Egyptian headdress and everything. So Beyond Lemuria is something. I said, I'm going to send you a copy of it. And as soon as you give me your address, not on
yeah,
the
yeah.
Urban
City. I saw his I saw him playing guitar on Sunset a couple weeks ago.
Oh, he's getting really popular.
Yeah.
And he calls himself Babylon.
Babylon,
you know, that one. Yeah.
Yeah, his music's hilarious.
Oh yeah, and I love that one. I like to get drunk in the car.
I wish I were Krishna.
Yeah. The best one though is I'll be God for just 1 hour. Have you heard that one?
Not yet. I'll have to download that.
Oh, that yeah. Got to listen to that one.
Maybe
I'll be
play
God
it
for
here
just,
and that, give
that,
him a plug.
That's the ceremonial magic one. You know that I'll be God for just 1 hour.
Okay, we'll close with that one after you and I finish. I'll play it.
Yeah, I think I've played it before on the air. But
anyway, he doesn't mind? Okay, good.
No, I'm sure he wouldn't mind. As I say, shameless self-promotion.
Exactly. I'll tell people where to go, download it, and give him 99 cents per track.
And be sure to get Beyond Lemuria so you can see Lon from delivering deathless wisdom from the top of the mountain. Well, I got to admit, I wrote the deathless wisdom, but still, we liked it. Anyway, I guess this ought about wrap it up. But give me, like I say, email me your mailing address, and I'll mail you a copy. I'll mail you a copy of Beyond Lemuria, and sort of in celebration, in payment for letting me self promote.
Certainly, yeah. Well, thank you for coming on here and, you know, bringing your notoriety to my podcast and. It's a mutual fructification of each other's magical careers.
Well, thanks a lot, Ed. Do you mind? I don't know whether we ought to. We could rebroadcast it on the Hermetic Hour, possibly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Sounds good. Take care.
You too.
Good magic.
Have a good night. You too.
Bye bye.
Well, and we just did. We just rebroadcasted on the Hermetic Hour, and I hope you all enjoyed it. Ed and I had a lot of fun, especially remembering John Reeves' guerrilla radio broadcast. Yeah, where does the dimple of Durga in Van Nuys? Anyway, next week we're going to be back on our program on the spheres of the Tree of Life. And next week, we are going to go to Chesed. That's Gedula, and that is on the Pillar of Mercy. And that's related to the planet Jupiter, which is the king of the planets. And Chesed is the image of Chesed, of course, is the ruling king. And we attribute Atlantis to Chesed. So next week, be sure and tune in and be with us. And meanwhile, good magic.